And you know, forests are my best teachers. When you think about a tree, it is the most incredible thing in the world. It makes energy. It nurtures a whole community. It puts down roots. It shares water. It shares oxygen. It shares shade. You know, it's this incredible kind of structure that really gives us a lot of examples about how we should live. So I think to myself, and as you probably know, in one chapter I, you know, exemplify the fig and another the birch tree. I just found all these amazing attributes out of the trees I studied that I almost try to emulate as my role models, especially because I didn't have any women scientists as role models, so I had my trees instead.
I just love that parallel that you had between inspiration and life lessons from the trees you were studying. The first chapter that really made me aware of that was when you were talking about being a new wife and, you know, juggling a marriage and studying gum tree death, you know, in Australia at the same time that you were trying to figure out how to keep your career on board. And then later on, you know, the tall poppy syndrome came in and surviving as a woman in science.
You know, I guess I would maybe start with that giant stinging tree because it might allow us to bring in stinging critters, which you talked about earlier as one of the quotes. But, you know, fancy being a tree because you can't run away from your enemies. And that's what always made me amazed about trees. And that's maybe partly why I got curious about things that ate trees, because if you're stuck all the time with your feet in the cement or your feet in the soil, as the case of a tree, something could eat you up entirely. You are just hopeless and helpless. And yet here are these amazing trees, so strategic and smart that they've developed all these kind of defenses against enemies. And I love the giant stinging tree in Australia because it was covered with incredible both physical and chemical stinging hairs. So if you didn't get poisoned by the toxin, you got averted by the crazy physical burning sensation when you touched one of these leaves or its stem. So I thought that was fabulous. But on the other hand, even maybe more fabulous was this one very cool insect called the giant stinging tree beetle that happened to be able to digest the toxins and had a beautiful hard shell, just like you know, most insects do, the carapace as it's called, and was able to, you know, meander around these leaves without getting stung or bitten the same way we would if we were on a surface of a stinging leaf. So in the end, it's a very cool example, of course, of plant insect interactions, an example of creating cool defense. Again, the trees win because the trees aren't totally eaten with all these different defenses that help protect them. So that was probably for me this wonderful lesson in life, and especially as a very naive girl in science, I thought, I've got to get my armor. I've got to get more defensive. I've got to figure out how to be smarter. And the trees taught me a lot of that.
Since you were a little girl, you had this love of nature, and you know, you also were very good at it. But then, as I got into the chapters where you were talking about the difficulties of being a woman in a male-dominated field and, you know, switching majors because of it and changing places in the world where you were working because of it. Now, what gave you the resilience and the drive to, you know, stay with it rather than just give up on
That's a great question. Sometimes I wake up to say to myself, what in the heck was I doing?
it?
I don't really think I have a strong backbone, and I did not have parents who were strong and bold and said, go out there and beat them all up. Quite the opposite. And I think I just doggedly had a little pathway. I was quietly pursuing that pathway, but I really had a passion for nature. So overriding all of those hurdles was this curiosity about leaves and trees and the thought that, you know, it's not like I'm doing something controversial. I'm not, you know, smuggling drugs and I'm not stealing artworks. I'm just wanting to learn about leaves. So why do I have all these hurdles? And I think I just pretended maybe they weren't there when I was out by myself in the woods and came home so tired from the exhaustion of field work that I slept pretty well and then woke up the next day and probably thought, why am I doing this? But then I went back to the job. So it is just a very funny thing. And I think all of us have those moments in our lives where we doggedly do what we do. And I think as a mom, I learned that even the hard way, but you know, you have to change that diaper. You have to feed that baby. You know,
yeah.
Even though you're exhausted or you're like, what in the heck am I doing? You nonetheless go ahead and do it. And with some of those hurdles about men in science and, you know, the competitive elements of being in the minority, maybe it was a similar thing to being a mom where you just know quietly that you need to pursue it, you need to persevere, and hopefully you can do that.
I just love how many opportunities you brought through your work to minorities, including not just women, but, you know, mobile restricted individuals, and also just people in different countries who might not have the same resources to grants or, you know, local resources or backing or any other kind of funding.
My interest in inclusivity and bringing in minorities came from my own sense of being excluded. You know, you learn the hard way. And I just remember so many times when I was on the out, or I was given the hardest job, or I was given no job, or the door was closed in front of me. And I thought, holy cow, it really hurts. And so that gave me an extra passion for helping others. And probably my empathy was pretty obvious. So I did tend to get a lot of the minority students as advisees when I taught college. And I tended to earn the trust of the priests in Ethiopia, whereas probably my male counterparts would not. So I did end up in a position where I could be useful and helpful. And of course, it took other time and energy and funds. I had colleagues in science, Americans, who just said, oh my gosh, I couldn't be bothered to do some of these crazy things you do. And probably that made me all the more determined to do them, because it's easy to get entitled in our Western world and think, you know, the only thing that matters might be a data point or a publication or some type of promotion. But there's a whole lot more out there for your job fulfillment. And I guess I was lucky, and maybe I missed the promotion, but I got this amazing life story where I did have amazing students to advise and fabulous experiences. One of my favorites that I talk about a little bit is a girl named Rebecca that lost the use of both of her legs after a car accident and was one of our mobility limited students. And not only did she excel in climbing trees and writing up publications about water bears, which was part of our summer research experience, but she dreamed of going to the Amazon. So somehow I figured that out, that I could raise funds for her. And I got my friends down in the villages in Peru to retrofit an outhouse for her and a bed so she could clamber in and out. And we even put a little platform on one of the canoes so she could roll her wheelchair into it. And so she got to go there, and, you know, sharing that kind of thing with somebody like her was just life-changing for me as much as it was for her. And I think those are the joys of being a scientist, hopefully, is that we can allow all these different brain cells to come to the table, even if they may look like someone who would not produce or, you know, provide anything. I think all of these diverse points of view are so, so important now. And it's given me a new sense of how to build canopy walkways that are, you know, handicap accessible, how to make sure that we can do things differently if we need to make field biology more accessible as well. And you think about this, how much we take for granted. How on earth can someone in the middle of rural Ethiopia with no electricity and, you know, no libraries ever understand what an aerial image might be? And then that, of course, educates all of us to know what we need to do to fix things.
You kind of highlighted that, you know, you grew up in a rural area where it sounds like your parents supported you in your naturalist pursuits, but they might not have perhaps understood the depth of your passion for it.
Right. Yeah. And I will say that's been one of the most amazing things. As I look back on my career, I say, holy cow, I really invented an entire toolkit for this new science called canopy biology and this new role as an arbornaut. At the time, I never thought of that. I never stood back and said to myself, oh my gosh, I've just invented a new tool. I was so doggedly trying to collect the data and answer the questions about leaves. And Yes, admittedly, when I first went up in that harness that I had sewed by myself, I was scared to death. I was shaking like a leaf, no pun intended. And I just had to do it because the minute I got up there was so much to see and hear and smell that I realized I literally had discovered that eighth continent. And of course, then nothing could hold me back. So I kept refining my ropes, I kept refining my slingshot and the fish weights that we use to put the line over the branch and making it a little better every single time and never thinking about the fact that, hey, nobody else in the world is doing this except me. I did find out, as you know, 5 years down the track that one guy in Costa Rica was doing it a little bit similarly, but with a crossbow. And so we were able to compare notes eventually, but it was truly a solo world at the time. And moving on to the canopy walkway, again, I thought, well, this is that walkway, even though I helped create the idea and the design, is owned by an ecotourist lodge. So I didn't at the time even take any credit for it or expect any credit for it. And it was only when I got back to the States and actually started building them that I realized I had, launched a movement, so to speak, with this new and much more accessible technique. Walking across a beautiful, gentle bridge is so much easier than climbing up a rope and perspiring and using all kinds of muscles you never knew you had. So that was fabulous. And then one thing led to another. I was part of a European Science Council that put forth the crane activities and another group that put forward these inflatables. So we suddenly had our portfolio of tools and it was really exciting and way overdue, mind you, to think about this in light of the fact that scuba was invented in the 1950s and NASA went to the moon in the 1960s. Here we are climbing trees in the 1980s and 90s. So that gives you a little sense of how little we know and how far behind we are with this arboreal world.
I think you mentioned in your book that we are becoming a screen culture and like how many people actually go outside, let
Right.
alone realize not just the beauty that trees have, but they have so many benefits to us as humans, obviously.
No, and I always tell people you should memorize this list to share at a cocktail party, especially my students. You know that trees give us fresh water, they control our climate, they give us medicines, building materials, they store carbon, they produce energy, they give us foods. They are the most important genetic library on the planet, and they conserve soil. And now we know they are this important spiritual place for about 2 billion people. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Ten wonderful things. And what's amazing to me when I give talks at business schools or to corporate people, they have no idea. They never learned about this thing we call natural capital. In other words, the dollar value of a tree is so enormous, but it never gets put in the accounting books. So people just think it's some kind of decoration that they can cut down whenever they want to expand a building or build a road. But in actual fact, we should almost treat them like these revered senior citizens in our communities and protect them and worship them and save them. And I'm trying now to make that voice for the trees, which I think has been long overlooked.
I was kind of fed, if you cut down a tree, plant one, and therefore you have a net zero. And in your book towards the end, you mentioned like that is not in fact the case. Like, can you tell us a little bit about why old growth in particular is so important?
Sure. And that is so important. And it even took me, a lifetime to really appreciate that because I've been part of many tree planting schemes. And when we do lose forests, we plant trees, which is a great thing. But it does not mean that we should stop trying to stand up for those old growth and big trees. Think about that poor old koala bear in Australia after all those fires. They can't live in seedlings. They can't even live in the canopy of a sapling. It will be well over 100 years before those koalas will have anywhere to go. So essentially, even keeping the koalas alive in a vet hospital will not help them because they will not be alive when those trees grow back from seedlings. So we have to think about the timeline of a tree, which is very slow growing for the most part. And we just don't want to go in and plant some other kind of tree that's not native. In the koalas example, they have to eat eucalypts. They can't eat some kind of fast-growing vine like poison ivy or some fast-growing pine tree. They only can eat their native gum trees. So we have this crazy impatience, I guess, as humans to think that we can substitute a sapling for a big tree. But think about the life in a big tree, and you probably got a snippet of it by reading my book. You know, the orchids are pollinated by specific bees, and the figs house all these amazing things, and the fig bird has to come along and eat the fig seed to poop the fig seeds and grow the next fig generation. And, you know, the bromeliads have 30 or 40 species living in their tanks. So there's just so many layers of life up there. And if you do clear cut a forest, sure, you could plant a few seeds, but how will you get back all those orchid bees and all those bromeliads and all those amazing vines? You know, this takes more than 1,000 years. It also takes a great big level of chance, and somebody needs to have a seed bank, but nobody really does for this kind of restoration. So we are really and truly fooling ourselves to think that replanting is easy as a solution to deforestation. We just need to save big trees. And that in turn saves all these cool creatures on the planet that we really, really need for our own crop pollination, for our own soil turnover, for our own different functions that keep us healthy and alive too.
You mentioned, you know, a lot of people are now aware of endangered species, but they're not so aware of the importance of preserving their habitat.
I estimate there are about 50% of the biodiversity on the land part of our planet in the treetops. So that means we have a place that has only even been observed in the last 40 or so years since I and a handful of others started climbing trees. And again, there are only a handful of people doing this, so obviously we have not detected the millions and millions of species that live up there, nor have we classified them, nor do we know if they're common or rare. And all of a sudden we're losing forests right, left, and center. So of course we're losing a lot of that biodiversity before we can lay eyes on it, before we can understand its importance, value. It's pretty, pretty scary. And it's just not a good thing to do. And we need a blitz on understanding forests. We need to direct funds to that type of research, maybe even more than we do to go to outer space, because Earth is our home and trees are this structure that keeps us alive. So it would be fabulous to really jumpstart some of this forest canopy research. And then once we know all of these things and all about them, we have to work really hard, because in my lifetime alone, half of the world's old growth or primary forests have been cut down or burned or cleared. And that's a really depressing fact. And it means, what about the other half? It's probably right on the heels of deforestation as well, unless we can get a bigger voice for the trees.
We're very real about the economic pressures from, you know, development in terms of, well, we can, you know, clear cut this and grow whatever product we want to grow. But especially in your work that you've done overseas, you mentioned that rather than, you know, timber or logging, if you instead build up ecotourism, you can give indigenous people very good livelihoods that also is better for the planet.
Right. And I think it's important to understand the supply chain first. When you read about Brazil, for example, and see all of the soy plantations and all of the beef and cattle ranches, it's easy to say, oh, those Brazilians, how disgusting. They're cutting down our forests and they're making millions of dollars. But it's really not true. The indigenous people living in the villages more often than not sell their timber for very small dollars because they have no idea what its value is up in New York. And once it's gone, they've taken with it all the nutrients. In rainforests, the nutrients are not in the soil, they're actually in the tree itself. And so that tree is gone, and usually the loggers burn the canopy bits that are left in big piles. So here are these poor villagers left with no soil, no livelihood, no nothing, and yet everybody assumes they are the culprits. And really, the culprits are a couple of the bigger corporate groups that farm these places, and B, American consumers who don't meaningfully try to destroy their children's lives. But if we buy things where we don't know where the product originated, or we purchase tropical products, we are contributing to that supply chain, and we are responsible for causing those farmers that are selling the beef and selling the soy to have a market. So we have to get smarter up here. We absolutely are responsible for so much of that. And that's why I started Mission Green, which is the last chapter in the book, because yes, we need to feed and provide jobs for the people in the villages in the Amazon, but they are not becoming millionaires by, you know, cutting down their trees. In fact, they're losing when they cut down their trees. So hopefully if we could offer them an alternate economic model, which would be ecotourism, and encourage Americans to go down to Peru and go to places like India and Malaysia and Mozambique and see these gorgeous monkeys and trees and sloths, then we can support these people with an industry that's not going to kill the planet and kill the rainforest ecosystem. So I'm just really, really hopeful. It's not a lot. We want to raise $10 million in 10 years to build 10 walkways in the 10 most endangered forests. How do you like that? 10, 10, 10, 10. But, you know, it's nothing compared to probably some people renovating a mansion or buying a couple Land Rovers or doing whatever. I just hope and pray that, you know, a few public philanthropists might read that book and think about that and say, hey, this is a pretty good business plan. We should give it a try, because nothing could replace these forests for our children and grandchildren. And we're hitting that wall right now where it's getting to a point, you know, where the planet is warmer and drier, and a lot of that's due to deforestation process.
We'll definitely link to Mission Green website in the story, because you have so many good resources there. You know, in particular, I found the rainforest guide very helpful for, you know, which products you should avoid, as well as I think you have like a 10 things you can do for the rainforest.
You know, one is make sure your kids and your schools and your libraries have books about rainforests and books about trees, and read them and give them as gifts so that people do get the knowledge. And, you know, hopefully through books like mine, it's not painful reading. It's fun storytelling, and it does educate people about trees. And then number two, look at your community and look around and say, oh, who's in charge of these trees? Is it the city government? Is it private property owners? But try to make a fuss and stick up for big trees. I mean, people support paintings and they build art galleries, or they bring, you know, ballets to their town. But why don't people start saying, we want to keep the big trees in our town as a real priority, as part of the culture of our town, and maybe create activities in these parks so that kids and families can enjoy them. And then also, on the other hand, is watch out what you consume. And it's not easy right now in America, because we don't have many labeling requirements on our products. A coffee package does not have to tell you where the coffee came from. So number one, go to your grocery store manager and make a fuss and say, I would like to have these labels better. And number two, write to your government officials, your senators, your representatives, and say, we need better labeling on our products. And number three, when they are labeled, buy the right ones. There's coffee that you can buy grown in the shade of the forest rather than clear cutting it. There's obviously timber you can get from Canada or Montana or maybe Vermont, and don't buy timber that comes from Brazil or Peru or someplace where you know it's very tropical. There's this extraordinary product called palm oil that's in a lot of makeup and shampoo. Do not buy anything with palm oil or oil palm. There's a couple other names you can Google and find out what they are, because some of the companies try to fool us, but we just can't buy any of that, because that alone is causing the rainforest of Indonesia and Malaysia to get clear cut. And yet it's in our beauty products, and shame on us if we buy any of those.
Do you think it's just a matter of people not knowing or not caring?
I do have hope, and I'm an optimist, but I do think people care. And I think it's because they don't know. And that's why I started out that list by saying, you know, read my book or buy a book about trees for school kids or for business people, because we need the knowledge to be shared. And I do honestly think that no parent or grandparent is saying, oh, I'm going to buy this product because my kids will die when they grow up. I mean, surely not. So I do think it's just the knowledge is lacking and we need to share it a little bit more transparently.
Been involved in so many projects, and obviously, you know, you're used to authoring things with studies and scientific journals and things, but how was writing the book compared to your other pursuits?
It was a labor of love because I had this hope and dream that people like you might interview me because I really want people to read about trees and I really want them, you know, to share the knowledge. So that was my aspiration, and I especially wanted it to be purchased as a gift for girls as well as boys, because I'm the mother of two boys, but I think to help them navigate their careers a little better than I did. So I am hopeful. It was also amazing. I had a great editor from Farrar, Straus & Giroux who kept saying, detail, Meg, detail. How did you make that harness? Why did you think about a slingshot? And I had to sit all by myself for hours and hours and kind of dredge through my thoughts and look at old pictures and recall, what was it like to have that elm tree through the little cottage when I was a kid that my grandfather had? You know, so they forced me to kind of really be introspective about my life. And fortunately, I kept a lot of journals always on my field trips. And that came in so handy because it could allow me to relive the freezing in Scotland when I was trying to measure birch trees, or, you know, getting leech bites in Australia and things that I might have otherwise put out of my mind. So mostly it was a pleasant thing, but writing is quite solitary. I spend a lot of time alone at my desk, but I also contacted old colleagues and we had wonderful times reliving stories and thinking through how it was that helped me a lot to relive some of those adventures. I think through my editor and literary agent, God bless both of them, I didn't really appreciate that I had accomplished so much, but they helped me say, you did what? You know, you helped build the first canopy walkway. What? You learned this from a fig tree? I mean, they were so kind of insightful and helped me realize that a lot of things I think we live through as human beings, we take for granted. In fact, one of the big ones for me was being a single mom for so long. My biggest issue was not losing my job. I never stood back and said, holy cow, someone should pat me on the back. I can't believe I did this, you know. And my kids survived and they came to the jungle and I organized them and I still published the papers and worked with the men. But, you know, at the time it was just like, oh my God, we've pulled this off. This was great. I never thought of it as a bigger accomplishment other than survival. And so I think by writing the books and having editors that were caring and maybe female in this case, you know, they opened my eyes to appreciate some of these things in a different light.
I thought was just, and I think it will really resonate with our readers because, you know, we're in advocacy and activism as well. And I think a lot of times people get hit with like, this is such a big problem and I am one person and I'm this age, or I'm, you know, a single mother, like you said, or I have all these other things going on, and it can seem so daunting at the start that you just give up before you start. And I think, you know, when you were talking about the Ethiopian church forests and how you just happened to meet this really passionate and dedicated on the ground individual who, you know, just started crying when he's like, this is what's happening in my country. And I think a lot of people would have looked at that and been like, well, you know, I'm sorry, but what do you expect me to do about it? And your response was like, oh, I'm going to learn everything I can about African plant conservation. And then even though I know that there's very little resources and I just have one person on the ground, you know, you just really threw yourself into it. And it seemed like that was, you know, mid or later in your career. And can you talk about that a little bit? And, you know, like, why did you feel like you were just going to jump into this new challenge rather than just give up?
I guess I probably didn't view it as daunting as it actually was. And again, I look at my life composition and think about the real challenges were being a single parent or dealing with these expeditions that were all male or trying to get a job when the tall poppy syndrome was rampant. So then I think, oh, fixing the trees in Ethiopia, I guess I can probably figure this out. So maybe building upon all those negative experiences, minimize the challenge of some of the things that were kind of big, but maybe were doable. So it's interesting how your perspective changes. It's like I always say to people, they're like, oh, you know, you shouldn't like change into your bathing suit in the locker room. I said, hey, I've had two babies. I'm not really too worried about too many things anymore. You know, your perspective in life kind of gets a little bit readjusted. And so maybe having faced those other challenges in my personal life helps me to deal with some of the bigger challenges in my professional life, if that makes sense.
I wanted to kind of go back to your message of hope and also just where we are versus where we could possibly be, you know, in terms of so many people like just plugged into their screens all day or, you know, just not really connected at all with the natural world. Can we rewire society to have a better appreciation of this planet and trees and the fact that they're keeping us alive and that we do need them?
You know, in all fairness, I'm very worried and I'm not as optimistic as I wish I could be, because I do think we're seeing so much disparity of Western people wanting more clothes, more renovations, bigger houses, more air conditioning. And then we share that model. Why do Indians and Chinese want big houses? Because they want to live like Americans. So we've really unleashed a monster. And so we're going to have to turn that around. And my one and only hope is the young people of today, if they can be smarter and more innovative than my generation was, then they can come up with great solutions. And I just pray that we give them the resources and the tools, and hence writing a book and, you know, sharing all the possible knowledge I can, or hence telling stories so they can be better and smarter than I ever was. Because really and truly, so much is weighing on their ability to come into this world and make it different. Because I am afraid that my generation, and maybe even yours a little bit, isn't about to perhaps, you know, give up their creature comforts, but we've got to help them figure out ways to have amazing innovations, you know. And I love when you hear of fabulous inventions where someone does something totally differently. And I just was in Portland, for example, where my son lives, and guess what? There's too much garbage. And the mayor, a couple of years back, instead of telling everyone stop doing garbage, he just said, oh, we're only going to collect garbage every 2 weeks. You have to keep all of your garbage until collection time. Do you know what happened? People stopped throwing things away because they didn't want all these smelly bags around their house. So, you know, he created a method to have them reduce their garbage in a very, you know, really, you know, innovative way. And I love hearing when people can come up with something like that. So solar panels on churches is fantastic. I have a friend who invented that technique. She's a minister. And now we have all these roofs getting solar panels. But why not churches? Because they want to save all of God's creatures. So every time we can come up with a wonderful solution, maybe it's a young person at work.
Is there anything else you'd like to highlight for readers about your work or your book or the importance of forests? Just anything at all that you want to emphasize or you feel like we didn't cover?
Well, you know, and I guess at the expense of tooting my horn, which I don't intend to do, but I will say, I just pray and hope people will read it, because nowhere else in the world does half of biodiversity live that is still undiscovered. It's this extraordinary, you know, what I call it, hit you over the head science. And I hope everyone can learn about trees and start to understand their importance. And only then, I think, will the solutions be forthcoming. And we need them to start as soon as possible, solutions, that is. So I do really, really hope that people gain a good knowledge in a painless way through my stories. It's sort of like taking medicine with sugar, and they'll really enjoy learning about tree adventures and arbor nuts, and at the same time come away with a stewardship that we totally need for this planet. And by doing that reading, they'll in turn learn new habits. They'll take their kids outside, they'll watch what they shop for, and do a bunch of the things that you and I just talked about in this conversation.